Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this special panel on critical inquiry and religious belief, science, religion, and the mission of higher education. I am John McCarthy. I am chair of the Faculty Senate, and I'm also a fellow here in the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. I am going to ask Doug Knight, Professor Knight, to step forward and make a few comments before I continue with the outline of the panel.
Let me also welcome all of you to this event this afternoon. It has been organized primarily by the Faculty Senate, at least they were the initiators of it, but we in the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture were very, very happy to come on board as well with it. At the same time, I also wanted to call your attention to a lecture that is going to be occurring tomorrow afternoon in this same room by Professor Edward Fisher. The Fisher is a member of our anthropology department currently this year in Germany with a Humboldt Fellowship. His lecture is going to be on the topic, The Limits of Self-Interest, Capitalist Vernaculars and Economic Moralities in Guatemala, Germany, and the United States. Hope you enjoy this session today.
Thank you, Doug.
It's not late, I was just teaching.
At the turn of the 17th to the 18th century, a debate erupted over the question of whether the world, as it existed, was the best of all possible worlds. Among the key contributors to this debate were Benedictus Spinoza and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, then Joseph Addison, Edmund Law, Albrecht von Haller, and Voltaire. This debate revolved around such enduring issues as the role of evil, the possible limitations on the divine powers, the human ability to understand God's hidden plan through critical analysis, and why the world was created as it is. Points of departure were not only traditional religious doctrine, but also growing scientific insights into the workings of nature. First and foremost was the view that an invisible force played a critical role in ordering the universe, the law of gravity. Even before its verification, via empirical observations and mathematical measurements, gravity was used to predict that the Earth was flattened at the poles and bulged at the center equator. The law of gravity was also used to explain the parabolic orbits of the planets around the sun and movement of celestial bodies at great distances through space. Equally revolutionary were the era's emergent disciplines of botany, biology, and comparative anatomy. The physical world became multiple, diverse, and changeable. It was governed by unseen laws. Leibniz added potent fuel to the debate on the best of all possible worlds concept. Using a philosophical and theological perspective, he moved beyond Spinoza's static, dynamic view of nature as embodying the divine, but without questioning whether an understanding of the universe requires the hypothesis of a God. The world, as it currently exists, he reasoned, does not tell the full story because without the possibility of change beyond prescribed boundaries, it would limit God's potential as infinite creator. The principle of plenitude, Leibniz argued, mandated an accounting of potentially different worlds, different species, and different types. Each thing in the constituted world had a value of its own, he reasoned, and the right to realize its individual value fully within the system to which it was attached. This world he declared to be the only one that could ever conceivably exist because it allows for change and the growing perfection of the parts and of the whole, a notion he designates the compossible. While not yet within the realm of Darwinian theory of evolution, Leibniz's theory of the compossible, his version of intelligent design, clearly points forward toward evolutionary and co-evolutionary theory. The human mind, he then likened to the mind of God, the realm of eternal verities, because the mind is capable of conceiving of the possible and compossible and of analyzing the maximization of diversity. Human understanding is, in fact, designed to explore without hindrance how the world functions, to explore the place of humankind in it, and the role that reason plays in advancing God's ultimate design. Minds are, and this is a quotation, images of the divinity himself or of the author of nature, capable of knowing the system of the universe and imitating something of it by architectonic patterns, each mind being, as it were, a little divinity in its own department, end quote. That creative dynamic allows humans to enter into what he called a society of God. Much has been written on the subject since 1700. Leibniz's specific argument has not always been recalled. What he had to say about diversity, plenitude, interacting subsystems, possible worlds in the creatively analytical thrust of human understanding as a godlike operation retains value for examining the relationship between critical inquiry and religious belief within the context of institutions of higher learning 300 years later. The panelists have been asked to address the role of reason and faith in the pursuit of science and understanding the place of humanity in the world. Each panelist is free to view the constraints, challenges, and opportunities posed by the intersection of religion and critical inquiry from his or her own particular disciplinary perspective. Of course, each will all do this in 6 to 8 minutes. A piece. The panel has been asked to address, however directly or indirectly, the current wars over evolution in the periodic press prompted by advocates of intelligent design. A fundamental assumption in that discussion, specifically in regard to our Darwinian theory of evolution, is that science is itself nothing more than mere theory. The hope of this panel is to avoid the Scylla of confusion and the Charybdis of distortion. The very different uses of the word theory, for example, provide advocates of intelligent design an opportunity to position themselves alongside scientists. Moreover, what is meant by terms such as the principle of plenitude by relativity or the uncertainty principle or string theory is not commonly understood in its scientific specificity. The panelists will seek to identify sufficiently faithful terminology. I didn't tell this ahead of time. But anyway, the panelists will seek to identify sufficiently faithful terminology without disavowing the roles of abstraction and complexity in critical inquiry or by not allowing God a place in science. Maybe God acts through nonlinear dynamics. Maybe God resides in the realm of energy and matter. Or maybe there is no reason to insist on a deity in an autopoietic universe. Well, we shall see. We are blessed with a list of 5 distinguished thinkers and academics, our honored guest, and I'm going to introduce each of the panelists immediately, and then I will turn everything over to them. They will state their positions, and following their presentations, there will be 30 to 40 minutes of time for audience reaction participation. We have armed guards stationed just outside the doors in case, and these windows will open if you feel the need to flee. Thankfully, we have a Catholic priest, so those of us who are Catholic can be absolved of our sins before we are crushed by the exile. Let me begin with Father Edward Monk Malloy, President Emeritus of the University of Notre Dame. He served 18 years as president of that university, overseeing Notre Dame at a time of rapid growth in its reputation, faculty, and resources. The university's endowment, for example, and this is for the numbers crunchers, The university's endowment is now about $3.5 billion. He is author of more than 50 articles and book chapters. He's the editor or co-editor of two books and has published six books. His latest book, entitled Monks, Notre Dame, was published in September 2005. He's an ethicist by training and a member of the Catholic Theological Society of America and Society of Christian Ethics. Father Malloy earned his doctorate in Christian ethics from, Vanderbilt University in 1975, and Vanderbilt honored him in 1998 with the establishment of a chair in Catholic studies in his name. Since he took the vow of poverty, he couldn't fund that chair himself.
It's true.
It's true, isn't it?
That's very true.
Father Malloy is a full professor in the Department of Theology at Notre Dame and has been a member of the faculty since 1974. Professor Douglas Knight is professor of Hebrew Bible in the Divinity School and the Graduate Department of Religion. He is also the director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. He is the author or editor of seven books, and two more are forthcoming. Now we know what he did when he was on leave. One is entitled Law, Power, and Justice in Ancient Israel, and the other is a commentary on the book of Joshua. Let those walls come down. Among his many articles are two that especially bear on our discussion topic today, namely cosmogony and order in the Hebrew tradition and ancient Israelite cosmology images and evaluations. With his doctoral degree from Germany, his academic interests lie especially in the social history of the ancient world and the ideological criticism of text. Doug was the recipient of this year's coveted Thomas Jefferson Award and conferred on him conferred on a distinguished scholar servant here at Vanderbilt. Professor Len Goodman is going to have to wait while I wet my whistle. Is professor of philosophy and Andrew Mellon professor in the humanities. A summa cum laude graduate of Harvard, he earned his doctorate at Oxford, where he was a Marshall Scholar and did not smoke pot. Of which he is very proud. He has written over 100 articles, essays, and chapters, and 12 books. Most recent among the latter are Islamic Humanism, published in 2003, and In Defense of Truth, A Pluralistic Approach, 2002. A winner of the American Philosophical Association Baumgart Prize and the Graz Centennial Prize, he has lectured widely and wildly in the United States. Len is now, he's always at work on a book, but the current book is tentatively entitled God and Evolution. Senta Victoria Vicky Green is Associate Professor of Physics and is a fellow here at the center. She is an experimental nuclear physicist whose research focuses on searches for exotic states of matter. Presently, she is using gold nuclei at relativistic energies to try to produce a quark gluon plasma. There comes that relativism again. You just can't get away from it. It is a state of matter that physicists believe existed 10 microseconds after the Big Bang. Vicky is a member of the Phoenix Experiment, an international collaboration working at Brookhaven Laboratory, National Laboratory on Long Island. Her professional hobby is trying to find observable consequences for a cosmological phase transition. I don't know. She has published more than 120 papers. Vicky earned her PhD in physics at Yale in 1992. And the fifth, but not superfluous, wheel on this engine at the front of the room is Professor Wallace Wally Listurgeon. He is Professor of Biological Sciences and Director of Undergraduate Studies. He has spent more than 25 years here at Vanderbilt. I'm going to focus more on his research because I find it fascinating, and I'm sure you will too. What did I do?
Struck a chord.
You're right.
That might be. I think my time is up. I'm sorry, Wally. Okay. his research focuses on molecular mechanisms of RNA splicing. I'm going to give you just a little bit of what it is that he does. Mammalian genes are interrupted by non-coding sequences called introns, which must be excised from newly synthesized pre-messenger RNA molecules before transport to the cytoplasm. You should be taking notes because there's going to be a quiz afterwards. This process, termed RNA splicing, must occur with absolute precision in order for the synthesis of functional protein. In addition, for genes that contain several introns, the coding sequences can be spliced together in different orders, thus yielding more than one protein from a single transcriptive unit. I'm going to use that as a bridge to the presentations by the panelists themselves. I'm going to skip and won't mention any of the 100 or so publications to his name and ask the panelists to try to address this bridging of various approaches as outlined in these introductory remarks. Each one, however, is free to speak from his or her own disciplinary perspective, and I will have to be a timekeeper, so don't be put off if I have to say, okay, we have to move on. Father Malloy, you, of course, will have twice as much time as everyone else.
Right.
Democracy.
Sure,
and you can either remain there, or if you prefer, you may come up to the...
I like to stand up because I like to see people. I'm really here as an amateur because I was here for another purpose. But they said, would you be part of the panel? I said, great. It's a very impressive group. So I'll just offer a few reflections if I could, and I hope they'll be helpful. This past summer, the Board of Trustees of Vanderbilt, of which I'm a member, gathered in retreat in Colorado. And a number of members of the faculty here came to present their research to us. It was very impressive, it was very much concentrated in this occasion in the areas of science and engineering and medicine, with a few other contributions along the way. The sum total of that reflection allowed me, and I think most of the board members, to appreciate the kind of cutting-edge research that is going on here at this great university. And it also allowed us to recognize how difficult it is to find a common language by which we could both interact and ask appropriate kinds of questions. The more specialized and particular the research that someone is engaged in, the more difficult it is even for their colleagues to fully comprehend the nature of what's being communicated there, and also to ask the kinds of questions that can enlighten a broader audience's reaction to the funded research that goes on in places like Vanderbilt. Let me begin by saying I believe in a unified theory of knowledge, which presupposes that every form of inquiry, whether highly sophisticated or not, has a value in and of itself. And using theological language, every pursuit of the truth is a potential path to God, or a discovery of the beauty and the wonder and the brilliance of God's creation. To make a claim like that is not, of course, to assert that at any given moment, any one of us, as particular limited human agents, can comprehend the full nature of the integration of that knowledge, or even the particular path that we're pursuing at the time. It is also to believe that there is such a thing as the truth, that is, an accurate description of the world and our place within it, its origin, and its destiny. Much of human history is taken up with efforts within particular faith traditions to plumb the depths of that claim, to account for the created order, to ascribe creation to a kind of agency and to give that agency name, to recognize the unfolding in history of a sense of time and a sense of development, and within various religious traditions to account for the future, either in hope or despair. One part of that inquiry, of course, is a preoccupation methodologically with the created natural order, but also the social structures within which human life takes place, and all the subdisciplines by which we account for things. When I was a sophomore undergraduate student at Notre Dame, I remember taking a philosophy course where I read a book which talked about the nothing but fallacy. The nothing but fallacy. And that is that all of reality is reducible to economic dynamics, to psychological perspectives, to the biological workings out of the human organism, or whatever. It has always been curious to me, if you look at the history of ideas, that when someone is brilliant, considered a genius in one realm of knowledge or understanding, they often are thought of as somehow all-encompassing, kind of like the old Renaissance scholar image. That is, the one human agent can be so all-encompassing in their knowledge base and in their wisdom that they alone, among all human creatures, have something special to say. And so Albert Einstein, for example, who obviously was one of the great physicists in human history, attributed to him a kind of understanding about other areas of inquiry that seems in retrospect to be utterly naive. A second perspective on this that I found helpful is the question, what is a door? What is a door? If you ask an architect what is a door, or a carpenter, or a poet, and you can fill in the blank, they will give you different understandings of what a door is. And some of those will be symbolic or indirect. They will appeal to another dimension of the human perception of things. And each of those can be appreciated in its own turn without necessarily being contradictory. In my perception, those of us who are not scientists, for example, need to be open to the very best understanding of the world as we know it, according to the methodologies we employ and the tools that we have available to us at a given time in history. If you go on an archaeological dig, say to the Middle East, and you go to a tell, you'll find that they cut into it now at an angle, because they know that in the future there will be more sophisticated ways of trying to unpack the nature of the civilization that lived there at different times in history. It's a kind of implicit recognition of the limits of what we know today. It seems to me that no matter what our path of inquiry, whatever our level of confidence about the truth that we've discovered, we have to have a humility about other paths to the same reality. That there is, in addition to a kind of pragmatic sense of things, a mythic sense of reality, which appeals to something in the human agent, and which religious traditions have provided. And mythic is not to say false, it's simply to say another way of trying to come to grips with the complexity, the beauty, and the wonder of things. I'm passionate about what I do, and I appreciate the passion and the time commitment and the dedication and the training that goes in the scientific community to discovering ever more about the wonder of the world in which we live. But I would simply caution an excessive level of confidence or predisposition to think that our path to the truth is the only relevant or a credible point of discovery of the beauty and wonder of the world around us. I think religious perspectives on reality have a special approach to the truth, and for within a faith community, they are validated by some combination of theory and experience. I think the reason that in institutions like my own, we teach science is because we need to if we would be a fully educated person, but we also teach a lot of other disciplines and they have a valid perspective as well.
Thank you, Father Malloy. And as I indicated, the rules of the game is that each presenter will make a presentation and then we'll engage in general discussion.
I'd like to start on a little bit of a lighter note, calling your attention, if you haven't caught them already, the fact that there are several spoofs or parodies out on the intelligent design notion. One that has been circulated really quite widely in the internet is called the Flying Spaghetti Monster, as an alternative to the idea that there should be an intelligent designer who set all this overseeing the creation of the world, ongoing creation of the world. Why couldn't it just as well be a flying spaghetti monster? The followers are called Pastafarians. The other is something that was published a little bit ago in The Onion that is called intelligent falling theory. The idea that things don't just fall according to some law of gravity, as John referred to earlier, but things are actually pushed down by God. Now, I guess that about anything that can provoke some such humor, I think, as well as disbelief, and for some people maybe even disgust, among vast populations of the population can't be so bad. We all need laughter, and all we can get. Frankly, insofar as our topic involves higher education, it's worth noting that these spoofs are exactly the kinds of things that we can expect from clever students who have bent toward needling various sectors of the society and the culture as they see it. And rather than trying to talk them out of satirizing a subject, we all may well have something to learn from the distance that such humor can provide. I'm going to focus my comments, actually, primarily on the notion of intelligent design, the current center of the storm. John indicated, the discussion, debate, or maybe even conversation between science and religion has a much longer history. It has had a very pronounced role in the 20th century on into the 21st century with the Scopes trial in 25, the Epperson versus Arkansas case in 1968 before the Supreme Court, and now the more recent iterations in Kansas, Pennsylvania, Georgia, probably here in Tennessee as well. I want to add an aside at this point. Is this concern a uniquely American obsession? I have several friends in Europe who have been amazed by the fact that this we continually return to topics like this, religion over against evolution. And it's hard to know exactly what it is that lies at the base of this. But I at least want to make three points regarding the notion of intelligent design, which is the current flashpoint in the discussion between religion and science. First of all, it has to do with the meaning of the word intelligent. Why precisely is the word intelligent used? Is that an anthropomorphic projection? Perhaps a narcissistic inversion of the notion of the image of God, that if humans are made in God's image and if humans are intelligent, then God must be intelligent too. There are problems with that syllogism. As any student of logic will know, it doesn't necessarily follow because these are both attributes on both sides and they're not fully inclusive of all attributes on either side. Frankly, intelligent isn't necessarily the first attribute I'd think of when it came to talking about humans. how about self-centered? So perhaps then with a projection we should think in terms of a self-centered designer. Now, I'm not a theologian as such, but it does strike me that this is a theologically suspect move to orient the notion of a deity and the deity's actions according to a human trait, in this case, intelligence. And this is the approach that seems to be taken in this notion of intelligent design. It could be that the intelligence was selected to describe the designer because of the traditions often found, including in the Bible, that wisdom comes from God. However, intelligence and wisdom are not identical. Wisdom has more to do with judiciousness, with skill, with experience, with contemplation even, while intelligence seems to focus a bit more on knowledge and reasoning. Why didn't they use the term wise designer? Are we supposed to imagine the world was the result of a supreme being with a perfect IQ score, whatever that might be? I won't even spend time now on the word design, although it also seems to suggest a certain formalistic take on existence. Aren't meaning and purpose of importance to the reality of the world as well? Why design, primarily? Or maybe we're supposed to think of designer genes, as in G-E-N-E-S. Now, the second point I want to make is that it seems to me that when we're talking about, and this does not come as a surprise, talking about intelligent design, really it's a kind of an under-the-radar way of dealing with God, bringing up the notion of if a design, then who's the designer. I noticed a couple months ago a cartoon by Stoller, who's a cartoonist for the Columbus Dispatch newspaper, in which five school children are standing up, pledging allegiance to the U.S. flag and going through it and coming to this point where they say, "One nation under intelligent designer." This is an obvious conclusion one could draw from this theory. So I ask then, which God? Or who's God? The religions of the world are filled with creator deities. Take, for example, ancient Babylonia with the god Ea, who is explicitly called all-wise, not intelligent, all-wise, and is responsible for establishing the earth, followed then by Marduk, who creates humans. Or El, another wise creator deity in the Semitic world. Or the myths of creation in Egypt, which are very complicated, or in Greece, including Hea, or Gaia, the image of the earth, the mother earth. There are even several different creation traditions in the Hebrew Bible itself. I'd like to suggest that whatever intelligent design is taught, wherever it's taught, and if there is the notion that a supreme designer should be discussed, that all of these great deities who have been worshipped throughout human history ought to get equal time with the Christian God. I think that would probably be anathema to the proponents of intelligent design, but certainly in the kind of political situation in which we find ourselves in this country, it would make sense, given the Constitution and fundamental values that we have. The third point has to do with theodicy. What about the natural disasters, the epidemics, the cancers, the bird flu, the meanness of many humans? Are all of these phenomena, which have been plentifully evident throughout the history of the Earth, are they also the result of intelligent design? Or are they design flaws? The fundamental problem with theodicy is stated really quite simply. Is the Supreme Being all-powerful but not fully good, or is the Supreme Being good but not powerful enough to suppress all disasters and sufferings and evil? It's a deep and lasting dilemma that's been dealt with throughout centuries now. I don't see that coming up at all as an issue within the intelligent design notion, and it deserves to be, I think. To my mind, in fact, it ought to be, we ought to think in terms not so much of somewhat of an abstract notion of intelligent design, but in fact something that is a bit more along the line of a just designer, if you want to have, or something, or a compassion or merciful. I mean, these are factors that seem to be left out of the picture of an intelligent designer. So, in conclusion, I would suggest that the notion of intelligent design is at its core unbiblical, unforthcoming, unhelpful, uninformed, uncontrollable, and quite likely unconstitutional.
Thank you, Doug, for the uncommon comments. Lynn.
Thanks, John.
Thank you all. Well, I too will say a few words about intelligent design. Let me start out by saying that there's a possible fallacy in it. The idea, whether it's a fallacy or not, depends on how it's taken. If the argument is that there are certain complexities in biological species which could not have arisen by natural selection, and that prevailing Darwinian theory, the new synthesis as it's often called, can't account for them. If the argument is that the inability of Darwinian theory to explain the origin of what is called irreducible complexity is taken to entail that that kind of complexity is in principle inexplicable, then the argument is a fallacy. The basic appeal is to the idea of irreducible complexity, that is, there are complex biological systems. Michael Behe has written about this at length. The components of those systems don't have any obvious adaptive function by themselves. They couldn't have arisen piecemeal. Mousetrap has no use unless it's put together, is an analogy I like to use. Therefore, natural selection can't explain it, hasn't explained it successfully. Therefore, there can't be any way in which such complexity can be accounted for without appeal to the notion of an intelligent designer. That line of argument is fallacious. It's a classic fallacy referred to originally by Spinoza as reductio ad ignorantium. The form of the fallacy is you can't explain it, and therefore there is no principled explanation possible. That's a mistake. It may be, and I think in many of the exemplars that have been used by intelligent design advocates, it has been shown, and that began with Darwin himself, that that many of those things do get explanations. And the typical method of doing this, and I can give you examples if you email me, the typical method of doing this is to show that those components of actually could have had, or in some cases did have, functions different from the functions that they have in the complex system in which they are found, historically had other functions in other components, and there was selective pressure for their usefulness as adaptations. However, I think that one needs to get past the notion that the idea of intelligent design is a mere fallacy. I think that there's a lot more going on there, and I think we need to get into it and understand the motives of those who make this kind of argument, where they're coming from, where they're going. I think they actually have something from which we can learn. Evolutionists, I would advise, should not get hot under the collar, angry, circle the wagons, get defensive, go to court. I think that the appropriate response to design, intelligent design arguments, is the Darwinian response, to keep looking, to recognize that there are many lacunae, many gaps in evolutionary accounts of the origin of living species by natural selection, to keep on looking for those, and to recognize, in all humility and sincerity, that some of the gaps won't be filled in just by making new empirical discoveries, but will actually require new conceptual work. We have a good model for that in Darwin, who found that natural selection by itself didn't explain everything he needed to explain, and he expanded his realm of models, his realm of hypotheses, to include sexual selection, for example. Stephen Jay Gould, up until the time of his death, was trying to expand on and develop the ideas of naturalism in biology to allow for other types of explanation. And in this respect, intelligent design theorists who are pointing out gaps in the evolutionary account of nature may be performing a very heuristic kind of role. Science doesn't progress without criticism, and recognizing that there are gaps, as Kirkwood did back in the 1960s, is not the same as being a heretic or an unbeliever in naturalism or in biology. It's a matter of recognizing that we never have a comprehensive picture, and that any of the models that we're using is likely to be incomplete and in need of itself being adapted and expanded and developed. The challenge of intelligent design presents itself in part as a lawyer's ploy, and you could see that in the work of Philip Johnson, who is a lawyer and is one of the great advocates of intelligent design. The ploy is one of wanting to shift the burden of proof, put the burden of proof onto the adversary. Show me how you can account for this, and show me how you can account for that. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but we have to recognize that the burden of proof in any proceeding which is not adversarial ought to be shared. I think that's the difference between a community of learners, like Father Malloy described, as we have here in the university, and a court of law. In a court of law, you're in a wrestling match, and you want to get the other party to have to present the evidence and shift the burden of proof to that other party. But in an arena like our own, where we're all possessed of little itty bitty fragments of a much larger picture, I think burden of proof should be shared, and we should all assume some element of it. One of the things that I think is very sound and very valid in the criticisms that intelligent design thinkers have made, not so much of the enterprise of biology or of science at large, but of scientism, is an arbitrary and a priori presumption on the part of scientific people that naturalistic explanations are the only kind of explanations that have any place in human discourse. You can see that kind of presumption made by thinkers like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett. Richard Dawkins takes the position that when you're out of science, you're out of truth. There's got to be a little more to life than that. Here I'm very sympathetic to what Father Malloy was saying. The a prioriness of that kind of presumption is concealed a little bit by a colorful and powerful analogy that that Daniel Dennett has made in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, where he talks about naturalistic explanations as cranes that build, they lift, they get their lift by building from the ground up, whereas theological type explanations he calls skyhooks. They descend out of nowhere and operate by a kind of entirely fictitious and fantastic form of lifting power. That's a presumption. That's a presumption. That's not an explanation. That's not an account of the nature of how explanation works. It's an a priori assumption which has ruled out any kind of notion that there might be anything in nature that we could possibly describe or explain in terms that aren't strictly mechanistic. We know that that presumption is false, although the colorful analogy has concealed the falsity of it. Human intentions, for example, values like beauty and goodness and truth itself, are not things that can be accounted for mechanistically. When we decide, I'm going to perform an act, I'm going to do something like that, our own intentions are part of the explanation. The goods that we pursue and the goods that we perceive are part of the world that we see and are not adequately accounted for. They might be reductively explained, but they're not adequately accounted for in surely mechanical terms. I think that intelligent design as a tactic by theists is a mistake. It's a mistake tactically, and it's a mistake strategically. It's a mistake tactically because one puts oneself on the defensive and opens oneself up to the possibility that new cases will be found, new explanations will be found, natural selection will explain this, or some new model will explain that, and then you find yourself refuted. It's a mistake strategically because it introduces and depends upon the idea of a God of the gaps. God is used only to explain what's inscrutable, what's otherwise unintelligible. Science can't explain this, so God must. And so God retreats into ever narrower and darker corners, and the light of science advances, and God is gradually diminished. I think that the proper role for God is to explain everything ultimately and nothing proximately. Leave that to the other forms of explanation. I don't think that a God of the gaps is a wise move for the theists. I think there's a good deal of value to be seen in nature. I think that the real motive and proper aim of the rhetoric of intelligent design is celebratory. I think that the intelligent design theorists, when they say, as it says in the book of Job, you can't explain this, and how are you going to explain that? What they're really getting at is the thinness and shallowness of mechanistic explanations, reductive explanations, the it's only this or nothing but that kind of explanation. And I think in that kind of rhetoric, they're making a good point, but like many points, that maybe their hair covers it a little bit. Which brings me to one practical conclusion with which I'll end. I think the question of whether intelligent design should be taught in schools is not a proper question to be addressed in courts of law or legislative forums or school boards. I think that that question is based on a misunderstanding of the nature of teaching. When people say, should evolution be taught, should gravity be taught, should this or that be taught, they're tending to assume that teaching something means inculcating and indoctrinating. I think intelligent design is a very valid topic to be taught. It's a subject to be analyzed and discussed. It's a possibility for opening up a dialogue between the sciences and the humanities, where we can ask ourselves, what kind of explanation can science offer? What kind of explanation goes beyond what science can offer? Where is the proper relationship? What do we see in nature that can't be explained mechanically? What do we see that can? I think that this is a fruitful arena for a kind of conversation in which dogmatists of both sides will be very much hampered by their dogmatism, but people with open minds will find that they have a lot to say to each other. Thank you.
Thank you, then. Next speaker, okay, we'll do you last. Is that okay? All right, we'll move on to the biological sciences.
I think my presentation today will be a bit more pragmatic and perhaps more reflective of the fact that I am a biologist. In fact, I'm one of tens of thousands of biologists that live in growing fear today that someday, perhaps soon, non-scientists and maybe politicians will tell us what science is and what to teach. So I do sometimes get a bit emotional on this subject, and I hope I have your forgiveness in advance. I'll start with my conclusion. It's the same conclusion that Pope John Paul proclaimed some 10 years ago, namely that randomness followed by selection, which are the core mechanisms of evolution, is the best argument today for intelligent design. And it's simply unfortunate that so many people today are so informed that they do not understand this point. To help make this point in a brief period of time, I'd like to start by creating a mental image of the day I fear the most. Imagine I'm halfway through the semester teaching a class in advanced molecular genetics. I'm teaching about 60 students that have been studying science for many years. They hope someday to use evolutionary principles to help defend society from avian flu. They hope to help develop completely new genomic therapies for diseases that we cannot treat today. So imagine on this day, I turn to the students and I say, today it's time for me to present the truth. In my notes, I have it in all caps. I know you hear a lot about the truth on AM radio. You hear a lot about the truth on certain news channels. But today it's important for you to forget what you know about physics and chemistry. Today it's important for you to forget geology and what you know about plate tectonics. Today you must forget about the fossil record and even astronomy. And of course, what you've learned in biology, biochemistry, and even genetics. Because the truth is that everyone in this classroom, everyone on the face of the earth today, can trace their ancestry to a fellow named Noah. And people who claim to know about Noah argue that he lived about 4,000 years ago. So students, you see we have a problem. This is totally inconsistent with what we think we know today about genomic diversity in the human population. And yes, it's very true, but I cannot explain, because of this truth, where the Chinese came from, where the Africans came from, where the Europeans came from, where the Aborigines came from. So my predicament then, and this perhaps is controversial, is that for a biologist, it's like walking into class and saying, students, the earth is flat. As a biologist, when I hear a person talk about intelligent design, my first thought is how little they really know about molecular mechanisms of life. So we're not going to worry about male nipples. We're not going to worry about a little thing called the appendix. We're not going to worry about the fact that our lower backs are not well designed to support our thoracic weight, or that, like mammals, our internal organs are suspended from our backs. Rather, let me tell you an interesting story about the piloerector muscle. At the base of every hair on your body is a little muscle, the piloerector muscle. It's innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. If I take a mouse or a chimpanzee and I place them outside on a freezing day, their fur will fluff up and it will protect them from freezing. If you or I go out on a freezing day, the hair on our arm will stand up and we'll see goosebumps, direct evidence that that little piloerector muscle is pulling that hair erect to try to give us thermal protection. But it doesn't. It's a fail system. And how does this speak to intelligent design of humans? Think about all the wasted genes, the wasted enzymes, the wasted muscle energy, the wasted nerves, just a total waste. But as evolution predicted long ago, as we pass through time, we hold on to our ancestral genes. We have all the genes of our ancestors. Today, we can actually look at the organization of genes in chimpanzees and humans, and we can find direct evidence for the statement that I just made. We hold on to our ancestral genes. Scientists want evidence, we want facts, we want to understand the how and the why. Without this kind of knowledge, there is nothing we can do to design new therapeutic techniques. So in the last minute or so, I'd like to give an example of molecular randomness followed by selection. This is the kind of thing that puts non-scientists to sleep. But somehow, someday, scientists must make an effort to communicate better, or indeed someone else will tell us what to teach. So I'm going to hold up the biochemical pathway for the conversion of lanosterol to cholesterol is 19 reactions. Every reaction is a high energy reaction. 19 reactions requiring specific enzymes, two high energy electrons and diatomic oxygen. And the difference between lanosterol and cholesterol is only two carbon atoms and two protons. This is, to a biochemist, shattering evidence of randomness. Why do that? And then why undo it here? And why do it again there? And why take it off there? But there was a time when cholesterol gave animals survival value, and it has been selected. And from that time, we don't tamper with these genes, because if we do, we cease to exist. That's the fundamental mechanism and the driving force for the conservation of ancestral genes. So we see, even at the molecular level of life, randomness followed by selection. That is the true genius of creation. It not only led to the origin of life on this planet, but it continues to create today.
Thank you very much, Wally. And our final panelist is Mickey Green, a physicist.
Artificial selection.
Well, I only read the large print on the poster about what we're going to talk about. So I'm going to talk about teaching science, which is my role in the mission of higher education. But as anyone of my fellows in the science and religion discussion know, I like to define my terms. So I'm going to start by defining, well, actually, I'm going to cite some good definitions of science. So there's one I think of as the classic definition, where science is committed by definition to empiricism, by which I mean that scientists seek to find truth by observation, experiment, and calculation, rather than by studying sacred books or achieving mystical states of mind. And this is a definition from Philip Johnson, the originator of intelligent design. It's a good definition. There's the technological definition. I define science as the organization of our knowledge in such a way that it commands more of the hidden potential in nature. So you harness nature. That's from Jakob Bronowski. And then there's the purely practical definition. He was allying himself to science for what was science but the absence of prejudice backed by the presence of money. That's Henry James. Personal favorite. So I'm also going to talk about intelligent design and creationism, but I'm really going to focus on science education because I think there's a much deeper problem than the teaching of intelligent design. I started thinking about this because I was reading these Pew poll results, and they showed that, among a good many other things, 67% of white Christians favor teaching creationism along with evolution. There's no difference in these numbers between evangelicals, mainline Protestants, and Catholics, all about 67%. Among those who believe in evolution and natural selection, 62% believe that creationism should be taught along with evolution. Why do so many people, without either scientific or religious predilection, favor teaching creationism in a science class? I thought this was an interesting question. To me, these results suggest that many people in this country do not understand science, either its definition or as a process of inquiry, regardless of the facts that the teachers might have put before them. And the resulting gaps leave a lot of space for a lot of unfortunate ideas to rush in. And I don't mean just intelligent design, but a lot of unfortunate ideas. So I'm going to give you a description of science from the National Academy of Science, because I want to work with this a little bit. Science is practiced in many ways besides direct observation and experimentation. Much scientific discovery is done through indirect experimentation and observation in which inferences are made, and hypotheses generated from those inferences are tested. And I just want to show you a simple example of an inference. Here's a sequence of photographs of a drop of water hitting a basin of water, and time goes from left to right and top to bottom. Look at the drop, you note the crown that forms, and then you see the spike form in the middle, and finally in the last photograph, a droplet separates off from this spike. Okay? We accept as we look at this that there's a continuous evolution from the initial drop to the separation of the droplet at the end. You know, this is something that we wouldn't really question. We can fill in these ideas. So this isn't foreign to us to fill in gaps. So I want to say something about why do I think this problem exists? Why do so many people not understand what science is despite years of science classes and my best efforts? I'll emphasize physics for two reasons. One thing is I'm a physicist and this is where all my teaching experience lies. And the other thing is physics is, for the moment, I would say, removed from the controversy, although I'm starting to see attacks on the Big Bang. But it's further removed from the controversy than biology. And this makes it easier to talk about while sharing a lot of the same pedagogical and cultural problems. So I argue that there's a lot of reasons, many, perhaps most people don't understand science well enough to be able to classify descriptions of nature as scientific or not scientific. These reasons include private universes, bad science teaching, that's obvious, bad translations, scientific arrogance, I've heard a couple of allusions to that and it's absolutely true, the science is religion problem, and general complacence since the Cold War, I'd say. So first of all, private universes. People all have their own theories about how nature works. These are set very early. They can be as firmly held as any religious conviction. They can be more elaborate than epicycles, and they can be very, very wrong. There's a well-known videotape that shows recent Harvard graduates and Boston City High School students and even at least one tenured professor at Harvard struggling to explain why it is warmer in the summer and colder in the winter. All have a similar wrong picture, and what's more, it's very hard to replace this picture with the correct explanation, despite the fact that you see the teacher trying over and over again with a very bright high school student. It's very hard to replace this picture with the correct explanation that seasons come from the tilt of the Earth's axis relative to its orbit around the sun. So people have their own private images that are hard to overcome. Bad science teaching. Much of bad science teaching can be summed up in the words of Wolfgang Pauli. This isn't right. It isn't even wrong. And here's the picture. Okay, this is an example of bad science teaching. This comes from a high school physics textbook. And it shows a very nice picture. I'd love to see this in a textbook. There's a balloon full of water, and they're dropping a dart down, and it explodes. And in the moment after the balloon bursts, you can see the water before it splats. And you can see it retain the shape of the balloon for just a moment. The caption says, "It had long been a theory that a liquid did not retain its shape when removed from its container. Scientists were forced to change that theory after observing the photographs shown here." In reality, there was never such a theory. The authors of the textbook invented this theory. It's the inverse of the concept that a liquid conforms to the shape of its container that we all, that's probably part of everyone's private universe even. But this is part of the definition of a liquid. It's not theory about liquid. And even if you substitute definition for theory in the caption, it doesn't help. No one's ever defined a liquid as something that does not retain its shape when removed from its container. So, and there's a lot of the bad science teaching. Another part of the problem is the difficulty of teaching in the language of science when so many people are averse to math and when enumeracy is so culturally acceptable. I have a couple of quotations about this. One is from Freeman Dyson. The difference between a text without problems and a text with problems is like the difference between learning to read a language and learning to speak it. And slightly older, this is from Galileo, it, meaning the universe, is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one is wandering in a dark labyrinth. So you're trying to teach without using the natural language. And then scientific arrogance fuels the fire. I think we understand this. From Ernst Mayr, What Evolution Is, we turn to science when we want to learn the real truth about the history of the world. This is absurd. I like to think that, you know, in my experience of meeting a lot of scientists, Dawkins and Dennett are the exceptions. Most scientists do not believe that the only truth is scientific truth. But this is a common idea, and it does happen. And then there's the science as religion problem, where Gary Taubes wrote an excellent account of a Yale professor of physics who spent years trying to reproduce evidence for a new particle he thought he'd discovered. His data analysis was based on just throwing out any data that didn't look right, and decades of wasted funds, and lost careers later, a colleague explained his motivations. Jack was on this Nobel Prize hunt. Jack was so convinced from his GSI data that it had to be there. It was like a religion with him. Another destructive idea. So I want to get back to intelligent design, and what I think is going on is that intelligent design advocates want to redefine science to accommodate the supernatural. And this is how they term it, and they say it very clearly. This isn't the plan. I'll read from Philip Johnson again. Creationists are disqualified from making a positive case because science, by definition, is based on naturalism. The rules of science also disqualify any purely negative argumentation designed to dilute the persuasiveness of the theory of evolution. Creation is thus out of court and out of the classroom before any consideration of evidence. With creationist explanations disqualified at the outset, it follows that the evidence will always support the naturalistic alternative. And from the October 19th cross-examination of intelligent design proponent Professor Michael Behe in Dover, Pennsylvania, Behe maintains that intelligent design is science. Under my definition, scientific theory is a proposed explanation which points to physical data and logical inferences. When I was in grade school, we called that a hypothesis, and we tested it. But intelligent design is not falsifiable. It's not really testable. The problem with this is that we can't arbitrarily redefine science and simultaneously maintain our dependence on technology. Here's what happens when we try. NPR, a few weeks ago, interviewed the distributor for Accugen, a company that offers genetic testing of the sex of the fetus early in pregnancy with an accuracy claimed to be 99.9%. NPR interviewed this distributor and said, there's no evidence that it works. The distributor's response, there's no evidence that it doesn't work. they're now under investigation by the state attorney general. Another one, predictions of greater warming due to doubling CO2 are based on positive feedbacks from poorly handled water vapor and clouds in current computer models. Such positive feedbacks have neither empirical nor theoretical foundations. Their existence, however, suggests that poorly designed Earth, which responds to perturbations by making things worse. this is testimony before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee by a Richard Lindzen, who is the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Meteorology at MIT and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. So, and again from the October 19th cross-examination of Michael Behe. Rothschild, the attorney, the plaintiff's attorney, suggested that Behe's definition was so loose that astrology would come under this definition as well. He also pointed out that Behe's definition of theory was almost identical to the NAS's definition of a hypothesis. Behe agreed with both assertions. Okay, and finally, if we redefine science, so this is a question that's a little bit disconnected, but just where my thoughts lead me. If we redefine science to include God, do we next expect science to test faith? So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you all the panelists for your succinct and very probing comments. Before we open the floor to questions by the audience, I want to invite you all to a reception following the session. We can go on, if you're willing, 5 to 10 minutes past 5:30. Okay, so are there any immediate responses, pressing questions, protests? Yes, please.
I read somewhere. So there are my sources.
It's a gap.
Yeah, on the whole issue of biblical authority, among the clergy in all Christian traditions, very small fraction say the Bible should be interpreted literally. Among the lay people, a much larger fraction. I noticed of the five people up here, nobody had completely positive things to say about intelligent design, and a few people had basically completely negative things to say about intelligent design. Is there a similar sort of bifurcation between the opinions of academia and people who have studied a lot of whatever, and the right, not just science, but a lot of anything, and the public? Is there such a bifurcation similar to the preachers and lay people?
Good. Good question. Good point. Who would like to respond? Not all at once, please.
I guess one of the things I would say is that the tradition of educated clergy, and at what level of education, is relevant to the question about the level of education of the people that they pastor or minister to. And if there is a significant discrepancy between the two, sometimes the values and the presuppositions of one will diverge widely from the other. Which doesn't necessarily mean if you have more degrees after your name, that you're smarter, or that you necessarily have a lock on the truth. But I do think that there is. When people, if you presuppose in the Christian clergy a divinity degree of some kind, and not all traditions demand that kind of education, I think it acquaints you in your study, for example, of the sacred text with the variety of tools available for interpreting that material. And the challenge then is having become familiar with the tools when you preach and when you pastor, not to become a prisoner of the tools. They're separable. But it does provide you with the flexibility of mind relative to complicated questions that may not always be available to those who didn't have that opportunity.
Let me add a footnote, and I think that's entirely right. Three short footnotes. Sadia Gaon, 10th century Jewish exegete and philosopher, died in 942, said, "We have to give preference to the external or surface meaning of sacred text unless it contradicts some other sacred text, some well-established tradition, the principles of logic, or what we know scientifically about nature. In that case, we have to interpret it figuratively." And he gave rules for how to go about figuratively interpreting it. Maimonides, who died in 1204, said, Quoting the Talmud, the sages of the nations triumph, or if you like, the sages of the nations prevail. And he used that as a rationale for accepting the teachings of natural science and interpreting figuratively wherever the apparent sense of scripture contradicts what we otherwise know. My third footnote is to Aristotle. And Aristotle said a very interesting thing. I referred to what the intelligent design people are doing as rhetoric. And the rhetoric resonates with those laypersons you're talking about because it strikes a note as far as what they think is left out by what they take to be scientific accounts of nature. What Aristotle says is that the quality of the rhetoric is going to be determined by the quality of the audience. If you've got a wise and sophisticated and well-balanced audience with good values, the rhetoric will speak to them. If you've got a decadent or confused or ignorant audience, the rhetoric will appeal to them. It's therefore the responsibility of those who use rhetoric to use it in a way that will enlighten and not heighten confusion.
Thank you.
Yes. Thinking about science, what science can tell us, and maybe that it may sometimes overstate its case. My question is, what sort of, when does a theory become teachable as fact, say to a third grader? You know, that these are your ancestors, and you know, because it doesn't seem that. It seems that the process of science is very sociological. It's not airtight in a sense, and it depends on consensus and communication, believing one another. I think one could argue that there can be sort of cycles where something gets believed, and then it's very hard to challenge that. And secondly, is science forthcoming always with its sort of assumptions about... it seems to me that one big assumption behind science is sort of immutable laws of nature, and which has to be assumed, I think, to get anywhere. Which I think most people is a good assumption, but it's still, I think, an assumption. It's part of the problem that science is maybe overselling its case, both in terms of its assumptions, not being explicit about them, and also not being very clear about when something becomes fact versus still a work in progress.
I believe that's aimed at one of you.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. For working scientists, everything is thought of as theory. And we rarely refer to anything as a fact other than a stream of data that comes out. The National Academy of Sciences, again, attempted to lay out some definitions, which are pretty good. And they define a fact as, in science, an observation that's been repeatedly confirmed and for all practical purposes is accepted as true. And they put true in quotation marks. Truth in science, however, is never final, and what is accepted as a fact today may be modified or even discarded tomorrow. And I think that's important for people to understand about science, is that it always has to be open to modification based on new results. And a lot of people will think, oh, I read in the paper, these scientists, they're always changing their mind. But it's generally new data that has prompted this. But the evolution is just a theory is kind of an odd statement, because, of course, everything is a theory.
I might just add something to that, and that is that when a theory begins to make predictions that the theory of gravity allow us to fly to the moon or to Mars, predictions that allow the scientist to know that if he isolates the gene for the seventh cervical vertebrae in a zebrafish, it'll be the same gene in humans. After you live through thousands upon thousands of predictions being preceding the observation, confirmed, it starts to start looking like a fact.
However well your GPS works, we still say the theory of relativity.
Joey, and then we'll go back to the gentleman in the back.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment, because you know, we haven't talked much about it, this language is so important. I'm a scientist, and you said that of the 62% of people who believe in evolution, evolution isn't a belief system, right? I mean, when I hear scientists talk about believing in evolution, or I hear someone referred to as an evolutionist, it sounds like, you know, a belief system. We have to remind people that, and we have to remind ourselves to be very careful about the language. It's quite troublesome. It says a lot about public misunderstanding of science, mm-hmm. that 62% of the population believe in evolution.
I'm going to, okay, I did say you, but if it's short, we're going to you, and then we have the woman in the back and then in the front.
I just wanted the question before about when does it become appropriate to teach science in the classroom, and I wanted to talk a little bit about gravity. Somebody mentioned the Intelligent Falling article on The Onion, which contained the completely correct statement that even scientists who support the theory of gravity admit that it is completely inconsistent with our theory of quantum mechanics. So why are we teaching it at all? I gave this talk recently about, I'm also in Vicky's department, I'm a professor of physics and astronomy, about challenges to relativity. I had a student in a class this summer say, why should we believe time dilation, because I'm reading articles that maybe Einstein was wrong. Most physics majors graduate learning nothing more than Newton's theory of gravity. Lots of undergraduate physics majors never do general relativity, and yet general relativity tells us that Newton's gravity is wrong. Quantum mechanics tells us general relativity is wrong, and we don't know how, and yet Newton's gravity is still right where it applies. All these observations and confirmations aren't going to go away even if we find a deeper theory. I don't think we have the truth, the ultimate theory of everything anywhere in science. But we know some of the pieces of it. And once we know them well, that's when you teach it.
Okay, that's a comment. So we'll go to question number one and then question number two, and we'll bundle them, okay? Anyone else want to get in line? In the back and then over here.
Langdon Gilkey, years ago in Nashville, said that his research indicated, as he prepared for the expert witness work in Kansas, that most theologians that he worked with had a better understanding of the history of science scientists did. And he brought that out because he was surveying engineers and scientists who believed in creationism. A comment, the question is, I think, as the physicist said earlier, that I hope that we can move from ID and origins arguments fairly soon, because it seems to me there are many looming issues about science that the average public doesn't understand, and there needs to be greater dialogue between science, religion, and ethics.
Okay, that's half question, half and half comment. We'll go to you next, and then in the back, and then here in the front, and we'll take you as the number five in this. Okay, and I ask all of you to listen carefully, take notes, and then we'll respond at once. Yes, I'm looking at you, I think.
With this issue, we hear so much about it over and over again. My question is, why are we talking about this so much? I used to work for a state government, and we saw a lot of fights over water quality permits, over discharges to a stream. And the fight wasn't really about the permit. It was that someone didn't want that development. But the permit was the only place where they could have a tangible debate and try to stop the development. And I feel that way about this teaching intelligent design versus evolution in the classroom, that it's the only place where there is a tangible point of argument. Whether you can face this issue in the court or elsewhere. And I'm wondering, maybe for Father Malloy and others, if we're having this debate so much about the classroom because there isn't a larger place in society where people can vent these concerns or issues or have their point heard.
Okay, thank you. And if you could actually identify one of the panelists you want to direct your question to, that would help. Well, you don't have to. You don't have to. I can always assign your question.
My question is rather general. The gentleman in the middle, I think, mentioned that one of the sound part of the intelligent design criticism is the critique of the a priori presumption of naturalistic material in this philosophy. If I understood you correctly.
That's correct.
Is this a problem that can be or should be addressed in science classes? Because it seems that a lot of the things that the 67 and 62% of people are objecting to is precisely that philosophy of strict materialism. Well, where are your all thoughts on that, I guess?
Okay, thank you. I think that was for you, Len.
I think so.
And now, yes, the intelligent-looking, designer-clad gentleman in the front.
That's a compliment to my parents.
Well, we know where you're coming
from. Anyway, I have a comment and a concern. The comment is, my problem with intelligent design is the confusion between apples and oranges. They want to teach religion with the name of science. But that's my comment. My concern is that the First Amendment, my concern is liberty in this country. I fear that intelligent design is a Trojan horse, and I'm a minister, by the way, but I don't want to, my religion, Christianity, has a history of violence, oppression, and persecution. And my fear is that there's some people that want to uniform all of us to be Christians born again. If that's behind the intelligent design, it's scary for me. That's my fear.
Okay. Maybe Wally and Doug, maybe you want to take that one on. And the last question.
I guess more of a comment as an academic community gathering. Pretty clear that the dialogue between different disciplines isn't happening. And I think that's a development of more contemporary education and higher education. Where at one time go to the Athena, go to the Aristotle and Socrates, it was all one. You went to the gymnasium, you went and studied music, you went and studied science, you studied literature. As we become so departmentalized, the scientist doesn't talk to the artist, who doesn't talk to the engineer, who doesn't talk to the philosopher. And I think until we address, as an academic community, for the sake of the future, this kind of question, does that mean going back to a core curriculum, that every student comes out of an institution, especially a private institution like this, is versed in how to think in different perspectives? I'm not sure we're working in that direction. I think that's what leads to the disparity between the lay and the professional. Professional has a diversity. The lay is coming out of our schools truncated and handicapped.
Okay, thank you very much for that that comment. We'll now have the panelists respond. I think each one of them has been identified. And then following that, we will have an opportunity to continue the discussion with some refreshments. Who would like to begin?
I'll start. I guess this is part of the response to your question. The great fear of parents sending their children to the modern university, if they are people of faith, is that some faculty member will bully them and take advantage of the hierarchical arrangement by trying to shatter their naivete in an aggressive way. I think the intelligent design is a reaction. It's a reaction to that. In the same way that scientists fear that this theory run amok will lead to inappropriate intrusions into the classroom or into the laboratory, which is a legitimate fear if you look at American history. I think the fear of bullying on both sides needs to be taken into account. So that it's easy to be an advocate for humility or appreciation for what we don't know or not, or what our methodologies don't allow us. You can only get answers to the questions you ask, right? So that limits what any particular approach to reality can come up with. I think in a place like Vanderbilt, faculty have an obligation, especially dealing with undergraduates away from home, and I'll have the same nurturing forces available to recognize that it's a time of transition and that if they overstate their case or if they come off aggressively or if it looks like they're trying to shatter the inappropriateness of the life of faith, that's not an appropriate role for a faculty member to take, which is different from saying, listen, this is how we see reality in biology or physics or chemistry or whatever. This is what medicine does. This is the only way we can, this is what our collective wisdom has led us to. Now, how that's compatible with what you believe, I don't know the answer to that, but let's talk about it. Or let's pursue it, or let's provide resources by which the conversation can be broadened. The more we can avoid the fear of bullying or excessive intrusion by our expertise or by the legal system, the better we're going to be, in my judgment.
Okay, thank you.
We'll
go right down the line.
I'll try to pick up especially the last question and also yours that you'd raised about the, and I like your image of the intelligent design theory as a Trojan horse. I think there probably are some grounds, legitimate grounds for being suspicious about the notion of the intelligent design idea. And that doesn't mean we have to be paranoid, but there probably are some agendas going on. I mean, why wouldn't there be? Especially something that has so much political play in the culture. I agree that we do need to have a diversity of opinions, that we need to be able to present in classrooms and other discussions a wide range of perspectives. My sense of the intelligent design discussion is that they would just as soon really not have that taught alongside evolution, but taught in place of evolution, which is the Trojan horse in that case. And it's the only other thing I might add is that this classic law case before the Supreme Court, Epperson versus Arkansas, and by the way, that's where Langdon Gilkey was involved as a quote expert witness on the side of religion. Kind of curious picture, but at any rate, this was that came out with a resounding decision by the Supreme Court that creationism, if taught in the school, if legitimated in the school as a subject to be taught, does run afoul of the church-state separation that's been ordained by the Constitution. And I don't see how intelligent design could fare any better. It's tried to circumvent it by not using the word creation and not using the word God. But it's there within the Trojan horse, I'm sure.
Okay, next.
Sure. I want to respond to two questions. One was about the motives of the people in the intelligent design movement, and the other was about whether intelligent design should be taught in classrooms. I think that Father Malloy is right about the motives. I think it's easy to see people's motives when you're sympathetic to their cause, and hard to see them when you're unsympathetic to their cause. I think that oftentimes in polarized situations, not just about ideas, but in warfare and any other kind of conflict, suspicion, defensiveness, feeling under threat leads people to take an aggressive stance, a defense based on the proposition that the best defense is a good offense. Intelligent design is such a salient. If you want to know the motives of that movement, I think a good place to start is studying the motives of someone like William Jennings Bryan when he came here to Tennessee to argue in the Scopes trial. He was not a know-nothing. He was not an ignoramus. He was a progressive. He was a pacifist. He was a populist. But he was very disturbed by research that he had read about the impact of what he thought was Darwinism, what others thought was Darwinism, on the officer class in Germany in World War I. He thought that it had been demoralizing. He thought that it had taught them that might makes right. He thought that America was at risk of losing its traditional morality by losing its traditional theology. and he wanted to protect the public against that kind of demoralization, which he thought would occur through a loss of faith. There were people on the other side who agreed with him about what the impact of evolutionary theory was and advocated it not because they were scientists, but because they disliked what they thought were traditional standards of morality. I think that one of the things we have to do in this country, if we're to engage in the kind of dialogue that the gentleman way in the back was talking about, is talk about the issues in terms of what we really think. That is, if we're talking about moral issues and social issues and political issues, let's lay our cards on the table and not fob it off onto biology or project it onto theories about economics or red states and blue states. Let's talk about the real issues where we have real differences, and let's talk about them in real terms. I think that a science class in a high school, like a history class, like an English class, is just as good a place to talk about those things as any other. But Father Malloy's point about not bullying in a context like that, whether it's in college or whether it's in high school, is terribly, terribly important. A teacher, a professor, whether that person has hints about an answer or not, is not someone who has the role of putting ideas into other people's head. What we have to do as educators and as thinkers and as fellow learners is to impart tools of critical analysis to help people to transform their naive faith, whether it's a naive faith in science or a naive faith in Christianity or whatever, to transform that naive faith into something more sophisticated. Let them build it for themselves. Don't do it for them. They don't come to a university or even to a high school just in order to get something prefabricated. They come to learn how to learn. They come to learn how to think. And that's what we have to teach them how to do. And a biology class is a fine place to do that, but it's not a place for inculcation and indoctrination.
Okay, thank you, Ned.
Well, just intelligent design should be taught in a school of theology, not in a science classroom. We're incompetent to teach the supernatural. We teach the natural physical world, and scientists just are not competent to deal with intelligent design. Has to be taught by theologians or addressed by theologians.
Okay, I have comments to everything, I think. the first thing is just a simple one about the comment about trying to mix apples and oranges, and I think this is something you commented on. I think what the people who are proponents of intelligent design are really trying to do is take apples and define them to be oranges, or they're really trying to redefine science to fit this thing in. I think it was your comment about where is the space for this dialogue. I think one thing that's happened is we're so leery of teaching religion in school that we fail to teach about religion. And if we could, I think if we could teach class about religions and have people be more educated about this, we could put intelligent design in, we could put all the world faiths in and teach this to high school kids. I think this would be very helpful. And I think you're right. This is a discussion that has sloshed over somewhere it doesn't belong because there's no home for it. Speaking of home, I think the dialogue, the first questioner and the last questioner said, why don't people get together and talk about this at the university? This Center for Religion and Culture is co-sponsor of this event, and we have a study group, Len and I are in it, and John, of course, and it is the study group on science and religion. I must admit, it took us about a year to learn to talk to each other at all, but it was really useful, and I think this is where these kind of questions can be addressed. And I just want to throw in one more comment, which is that I think the real question is, what is the motivation for this? And something that didn't get said, and I'm amazed, Len, that you didn't say it, that people are very disturbed because they wonder where the idea of an immortal soul fits into evolution. without someone or something to put it there. And I think this is profoundly bothersome to people. And so I think some of the motivation is trying to answer that question.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And I want to thank all the panelists for their the care that they took in and I also want you to give yourselves a hand of applause. And
all right, good job.
And you are all now invited to a reception, which is just beyond the door.
This is my meat.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
everyone.
That was fun. Thank you.
Nice job. Great job.
All right.
It was
very good. Thanks for doing it. It was a very patient group here.
Well, it was.
It's not.
Nice job.
The center connected.
Very nicely done.
Great job. All right.
How does it become for everyone?
Yeah.
But the other thing is,